It's a long drive from where I live down here, and I listen to the radio, unfortunately, on the way down, and so I just wanted to preface what I had planned to say with how fortunate we are to have a Sangha in a world so full of misery and suffering and fear and uncertainty, that we can have a place to come and be with like-minded people and extend our loving kindness, which each and every one of us possess in infinite abundance, and spread that throughout the world. And don't ever think, please, for 1 minute that you can't do that or that it's ineffective. So I just wanted to say that. Tonight, I want to talk about koans. I studied in the Soto Zen tradition, which does not emphasize koans, but they sometimes appear. Let me get my facts straight here. There aren't a whole lot of facts about koans, so don't worry. Don't worry about that if you're thinking you're going back to school. It's not exactly like that. If you don't understand anything I say, don't worry about that either. If it's perplexing, it doesn't matter. Just listen and absorb. Over 30 years ago, I would hear koans or read koans, and I thought, well, that's interesting, or what is that, or blah, 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 and forget about it, and pow. 20 years later, it would pop up, just like it had, you know, never been forgotten, but not quite the same. So you never know. So if you don't understand, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. The word koan, will you keep time for me in case I go berserk? Okay. There's a Japanese word, and it's from the Chinese word kungan, and which originally meant a public case, as in law, a precedent. And Zen people picked up the term for these cases, or koans, and they originated, oh, maybe 1,200 years ago, a long time ago. And I'd like to, I'll probably mention many times that here we are speaking about these words, incidents, stories right now. So what was the value that has gone through century after century after century? What is it? I think they probably originated, at that time in China, everything was quite in turmoil, and it's a huge country, and most of these occurred in southern China, vast mountain ranges. And I think students and teachers would sit around and talk about what happened in those days, much like we do now. They would make comments and hear stories and gossip. You know, like, did you hear that so-and-so asked Zen Master Joshu, does a dog have Buddha nature? And he said, no. And someone else said, well, I asked him that, and he said, yes. So what is it, yes or no? Or did you hear about old Pai Chang? He did a priest funeral for a fox. I mean, what was that about? Or did you hear about Zhu Yin? He's running around asking himself questions, and then he answers them himself. Is he going senile? I mean, you know, just, and over time, these they're stories. The one I want to talk about tonight is a story. And sometimes, and they're almost always an interchange between a student and a teacher. And sometimes it just comes down to one word. But anyway, a couple hundred years after that, they became sort of formalized, and then they became more formalized, and they were put to use. Students would give them to teachers, and teachers would give them to students. And here we are talking about them, as I said, today. Here's a couple of quotes about koans. This is from Stephen Batchelor, and he says, "The term koan usually refers to the particular question itself as well as the state of mind to be cultivated through concentrating upon the question. A koan, literally a public case, is a description of an entire situation, usually of a dialogue between a Zen master and his or her disciple. The central point of the exchange is then singled out as a topic for meditation." I guess meditation is as good a word as any to describe what happens. Robert Aiken, whose translation of the forthcoming koan is the one I like the best, says, "Koans are configurations of the human psyche, as in myths and fairy tales, but with a punch, an ability to be used to discover and penetrate our habitual karmic patterns of thoughts and response. They break up our reflexive mind." What koans are not, they are not puzzles. They're not word games. They're not riddles. Often the paradoxical is the term used, and they are not paradoxical. And they're not intellectual exercises. None of those things. So our thoughts and feelings don't really have any place to go if we consider one of these things. So what do we do with it? For my own self, I mean, I don't know where to start, but with my thoughts and feelings, so I ignored that. And you can do whatever you want, because there's nothing you can do, is what it comes down to. But these old stories, I strongly feel, are alive and well. They're still in use today by Rinzai Zen folks. Start with one, usually, and then another, then another, then another, and you pass them, and you get some sort of acknowledgement, and whatever. In the Soto tradition, in which I practice, koans are not de rigueur. They will sort of, they may well come up in your practice, incidentally, or your teacher may well assign you one, but it's not our emphasis on seated meditation, zazen. And I guess if we have any sort of koan at all, it's our daily life. That's the koan. And that's a good koan. We all have that one, whether we practice koans or not. The one I want to discuss tonight is the third one in a book called the Mumon Kan. That's Japanese. For the Gateless Barrier. It was put together by a wonderful man named Wu Min. First, I should say that all these Chinese names I mentioned, it's very complicated, and I've never understood it, because all these people were born with their birth name, and then as they become adults, I think they're given another name, sometimes called a respect name. Then they join a monastery and they're ordained, and they're given a Buddhist name. And then they receive Dharma transmission, permission to teach. They're given another name. And then they have a monastery, which is usually named after the mountain that it sits on, and they're often known by that name. So some of these guys have four or five or six names. Then there's two different ways to pronounce Chinese words into English, and it depends on which one of those you use. And then they're also have their Japanese names. So. And some of these guys have the same names. So it doesn't matter what their names are. You know, I'll try to stick with one or two and not confuse either myself or you. But Wu Men, Wu Men lived from 1183 to 1260. And the Mu Meng Koan is a collection of 48 koans. And there's two other major collections, the Blue Cliff Records, which is a lot of koans, and the Book of Serenity. Many of the stories are in all three. Many, they always differ, of course, according to who translated them. I mean, they've been passed on, remember, for 12 centuries, so there's lots of little details that shift and change. Like the one I want to talk about, and some, they say it took place in a little hut in the mountains, and in another one it says the man had a small temple, and so you just sort of look for what runs through and don't worry too much about details. Wu Men was, he had another name, of course, which was Hui Kai, which meant the lay monk, because he lived like a lay person. He never had a temple of his own. He never had a monastery. He traveled from one to another, usually on foot, his whole life. And he supported himself. He worked as a farm laborer. He worked as a day laborer. He wore his hair long. He wore old, patched, raggedy robes. He was sort of a hippie, I guess. And when he visited temples, he refused servants. He took care of his own needs. He washed his bowls. He made his bed. And when he was an older man, he retired to a small little house in the country, and by that time he was well known. And many students and teachers and scholars and government officials would come and visit him. But he was, his particular collection of koans are, he was known for being very succinct and brief, which I appreciate, and very poetic. And he opens his book with this poem, which is, "The great way has no gate. There are 1,000 different paths. Once you have passed the barrier, you walk the universe alone." Sometimes the last line is translated as, "You walk between heaven and earth." And this one, sure, I'll read. I really like this poem. I could just read it over and over. It's quite full of wonderful things. "The great way has no gate. There are 1,000 different paths. Once you have passed the barrier, you walk the universe alone." Or, "You walk between heaven and earth." That's just wonderful. The 1,000 different paths, of course, are each of us. So, a caveat. Many koans are, like fairy tales and myths, have violent or dramatic imagery. And people say, "Oh my God, he cut the cat in half? What kind of Zen teacher is that?" You know, or, you know, some monk kicks over a water jar and his teacher says, "Here, go teach." I mean, it's just, so don't take it too literally. It's like making a point. You know, was there really a gingerbread house in the forest? You know, did the wolf really, you know, put on, you know, try to grab Little Red Riding Hood? Is there a big giant up there above the beanstalk? No, but a point is made in all of the stories. Something that resonates somewhere in us, somewhere in us. Again, these stories are alive and well, and I guarantee you they're in your mind somewhere, in your heart mind. The one I wish to talk about is the third one in Wu Men's book, the third case, the third koan. And it's called One Finger Zen. So I want to read it because I want to make sure that we're all on the same page, so to speak. This is about a man named Chuchi. He was an old Zen teacher. His Japanese name was Gutai. And there's not too much known about him. Most Zen teachers did not write things down. Again, this was a long time ago. But the consensus is that he was a very good Zen teacher indeed. And he probably lived and taught in the middle 800s, say 850, something like that. Whenever Chuchi was asked a question, he simply raised one finger. And whenever I mention this, I'm tempted to raise my finger, but you'll see why I don't. Yasutani Roshi used to love this koan, and he would raise his thumb. But since he raised his thumb, I don't feel I can do that either, so I'll just raise my hand up. So whenever Chuchi was asked a question, he simply raised one finger. One day a visitor asked Chuchi's attendant what his master preached, and the boy raised a finger. Hearing of this, Chuchi cut off the boy's finger with a knife. As the boy ran screaming with pain from the room, Chuchi called to him. When he turned his head, Chuchi raised a finger, and the boy was suddenly enlightened. A lot of koans end with that sentence. When Chuchi was about to die, he said to the assembled monks, "I received this one finger Zen from Tian Lung. I used it all my life, but never used it up." And with that, he entered his eternal rest. Wu Min always has a comment after these cases. And in this one he says, "The enlightenment of Chuchi and the boy has nothing to do with the end of a finger. If you can realize this, then Tian Lung, Chuchi, the boy, and you yourself are all run through with a single skewer." But there's more to the story. When Chuchi was a younger man, maybe in his 40s, and had been practicing Zazen for many years, he went off alone deep into the mountains to further his practice, to deepen his practice. And he lived alone in a small hut alongside a mountain path in the middle of nowhere. And it was obscure, rarely traveled. And that's where he lived by himself, and he spent his days and nights perfecting his practice. The rainy night, he's sitting alone doing his zazen, and the door bursts open, and a woman, a Buddhist nun, enters the room. Her name was Shi Qi, which can be translated in the Chinese, Qi, right? Shi Qi, as true encounter, or true reality, or true world. It was a custom in those times that if you visited a Zen temple or a Zen monk, that you would remove your traveling hat or your rain hat, this wide straw things, and circumambulate the priest three times. And this was customary. It was expected. It was a form of greeting, and it was an offering of respect. So Shi Qi circled Chuchi once, and she did not remove her hat. She just walked around him, and she said, "Say the Zen word, and I'll remove my hat." Now, the Zen word is a term used in Zen, sometimes turning word. In other words, say the word, the point that reveals everything. She says, "Say the Zen word, and I'll remove my hat." Chuchi is sitting there, you know, completely at a loss. He didn't know what to say. He tries to find a Zen word, which already he's done for, right? He was completely dumbfounded. Two more times she circles Chu Chi. And each time she says in a loud voice, say the Zen word and I'll remove my hat. And each time he can't do it. So she turns around and walks out the door into the dark and into the rain. And he comes to his senses, as it were. He jumps up, he runs to the door, and he says, it's cold, it's wet outside, it's dark. Please come back. There's room for you here. And she yells back. She says, say the Zen word, and I'll come in. And he could not, and she left. So he closes the door. And just, I would assume with a sinking heart, he decides that he cannot practice. It's not for him. It's a big mistake. He's a fool for even trying. He's a loser. It's all a waste. I might as well go get a job. You know, he just he doesn't have what it takes. So he packs up his belongings and decides to leave the next morning and lay down and get some sleep first. So he does. He falls asleep, and as he sleeps, the spirit of the mountain comes to him in a dream. And the spirit says, don't leave. A great Zen master will come this way soon. And you can tell him, you can discuss this matter with him. So the next morning, Chu Chi unpacks his things and he settles down to wait. And within a couple of days, Tian Lung shows up, comes trudging down the road. Tian Lung being a well-known, well-respected Zen master. So, Chu Chi welcomes him, prepares him some tea. They sit down, and Chu Chi tells him the story of his intentions to practice, of the visit from this wild woman in the middle of the night, of the dream, and finally, he tells him of his feelings of hopelessness and despair. And Tian Lung looked at him and raised one finger. And of course, Chu Chi was completely and utterly enlightened at that moment. So that's all that's known about that incident, plus what I made up. But, so what do you do if a teacher gives you this, or just as likely, I mean, you can read it in a book, or hear it, and what do you do with such a story? Why has it lasted so long? What value has it? There's some points that there are some points that we can make. You know, obviously, or so it seems. One point would be the cutting off of the boy's finger. Wu Min says that Chu Chi's and the boy's enlightenment have nothing to do with the finger. But maybe it has to do with the raising of the finger, an entirely different gesture. When the boy raised his finger, it was a dead gesture. He was imitating Chu Chi. It wasn't Chu Chi's finger he was raising. It wasn't his own finger he was raising. He was imitating. And the inference there is that you cannot practice someone else's practice. You can only practice your own. If you do attempt to practice somebody else's practice, there are consequences. In this case, the boy lost a finger. But you lose something. You must have your own Buddhist practice. Who else is breathing your breath but you? Who else is sitting here but you? Who else reads the sutras but you? The boy had to have a shocking experience before he realized that. And another point to make. This is a woman, a very good Zen teacher in New York, Westchester County, mentioned this to me some time ago. She thought very, very important to her that here is this boy with his finger whacked off, blood all over the place, screaming, running out of the room. His teacher calls him, and he turns around. So what sort of relationship What sort of relationship would compel you to turn around when you're in such fear and pain? What would turn you around? Something turned that boy around. Something in that boy. Chu Chi's dying words: I received this one finger Zen from Tian Lun. I used it all my life, but I never used it up. And again, here we are, 1,200 years later, and it's still not used up. Tian Lun's finger is still in the air. But the boy couldn't use it. You know, he says, Tian Lun's finger, I never used it up. But Chu Chi used it. I mean, can I use it? Can you use it? And Shi Qi, who I find very interesting, I mean, who was this wild woman who comes out of nowhere and bangs open the door? True world, true reality, true boundary sometimes, true encounter, her name is interpreted as, you know. And why was it a woman who opens the door in this most patriarchal of societies? And what was Chu Chi thinking on that dark night, alone, safe in the mountains, thinking, I'm just going to sit here and do my Zazen and my Buddhist practice, and I'll gain release in the trials and tribulations of the world. Something like that, maybe. So do we really think we can meet the world on our own terms? Haven't we tried that? Isn't that why we're here? Maybe we've tried that. Doesn't work so well. And even so, he was obviously sincere, you know, and committed. He was trying very hard. There is some value to that, even if he was not quite doing it right. And the mountain spirit and the dream, I mean, can it be that all the world seen and unseen is urging you to practice, is telling you things everywhere you turn? Are you willing to receive guests? Can you separate out? I mean, he had a dream. Dreams are very important, you know. But how do you separate the mystical gobbledygook crap from practice? A practice dream. If you continue to practice, you will. It's pretty easy. The mountain spirit. And then Tian Lung shows up. Chu Chi receives him with respect. And despite of and because of his hopelessness and humiliation, he pours out his heart. There's nothing left. He's exhausted his resources. And at that moment, Tian Lung raises his finger. So, you know, practice will grab you if you're willing. Suzuki Roshi, founder of Zen Center, used to say, first of all, he loved beginning students. And he would say, to begin to practice Buddhism is a lot like getting on a train. And once you get on the train, it starts moving and you can't get off. So this is what I think happened with Chu Chi. You know, the mountain spirit wants to talk to you. Your dreams want to talk to you. A koan is one way or medium by which you connect with what is alive and vibrant within yourself, underneath and within and without of this sort of this encasement we have with thoughts and feelings and ideas and habits. All this stuff's waiting, you know. The other day I'm walking through it. I live on the in Guerneville on the Russian River, and up the hills a little ways from the town. And I was walking to the post office, and I was thinking about what to say here. And I did want to say something about a koan or koans. And I'm walking by, and I brushed by a blackberry bush, and it tugged my sleeve, and I looked down and I saw this small, elegantly curved, perfectly curved little purple thorn, caught, a little crescent caught in my sleeve. mean, it was attached to this slender, maybe 8 foot long, green and purple bramble branch that extended back into the brambles and the bushes. And it seemed to me vibrant, very vibrant and very much alive, and it was trembling with intelligence. I felt the whole universe was right on this point, right here. Perfect little crescent point. So what about your point? Your blackberry thorn. Your Shi Chi in the night. Your raised finger. If you have the faith of Chu Chi in Buddha's way, if you embrace your doubt and your perplexity, and if you persevere in your practice, you will find that point. You will find that point. The old Rinzai masters used to say that just as surely as you raise your foot and bring it down, you will stamp the earth. Oh, I have to say, tonight anyway, about that particular koan. And I assume that we have, 10 minutes if we want. If anyone has comments or questions, I'll try to answer them. Yes, sir.
Not a question, but just a comment. My psychiatrist just had a child, and he was married to a Japanese woman. They named the child Koan. They changed the spelling because in Japan it's also the spelling of the characters for light and dark.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes.
Really? I never knew that. Thank you very much. Koan, light, dark. Yeah.
Actually, it's dark.
Dark light, dark and light. Wow.
First one is dark.
Wow. Wow. Is that a new or a strange topic for this particular group, koans? I mean, everyone knows the word, right, or some idea. Yeah. So do you get some idea of they're workable? I mean, how do you work? I mean, my question always was, like, well, what do you do with a koan? You know, I mean, you actually do something with it. Basically, you don't do much. Teachers also will assign you personal koans, or you can come to a teacher and say, this is my koan. I've got 3 kids and I'm looking for work and I don't have any time. I mean, well, this could be a problem that's sort of sociological and psychological, but it could also be a practice problem, not a psychological problem. So you can worry it all you want with your thoughts and feelings, but if you just let it sit there, whatever the koan is, when you get up in the morning, you know, what is the raised finger? While you're brushing your teeth, when you sit down to eat, raise finger. Does a dog have Buddha nature? Yeah, that's the one that Rinzai people always start their students with. Is does a dog have Buddha nature? No. I think in Chinese, no is nu, and in Japanese is mu, but we tend to say mu. So they've got it down to one word. So if you're a beginning Rinzai Zen student, your first koan will probably be ma or mu. That's it. No stories, no explanations. Ma, day and night. It just sort of sits there. Wu Men's first koan was mu, and it took him 6 years. He used to wander around the monastery in the middle of the night, so distracted he would like bang his head against the wall to sort of keep awake while he tried to figure it out. You know, but they have a way. They have a way with you. Anyway, I'm taking up your question. I'm sorry, question time in case someone, anyone else had anything to say. Mm-hmm.
This is the second time in very recent past that I have heard koans the first time. So mm-hmm. It seems like still a continuous experience. And,
mm-hmm.
Still feels like the first time. I was struck by the fact that the koan had really resonated with some parts that had no language.
Right.
So even before you gave a little bit of an explanation, or not explanation, a little more to the why the raised finger, why the master's raised finger works and the boy's doesn't.
Yeah.
That is extremely interesting. It's just a lot of people in this room were smiling.
Mm-hmm.
There's something, some beauty in there. That so that here is one way, and I can see why, you know, that really has a very visceral sort of a connection. It's just extremely calming and beautiful somehow. But then you did sort of work with it almost like, you know, in literature class, a teacher might work with a poem.
Mm-hmm.
And that really involves ideas and thoughts.
Yes, it does.
So when people work with koans, and you said it doesn't have to do with ideas and thoughts, didn't you begin with that? It has nothing to do.
I did. It has nothing to do with words and thoughts. But I don't know how, with words, with thoughts and feelings, I said. But I don't know. I don't. But how else am I going to communicate with you at this point without thoughts and feelings?
The question is, does the student use, sort of analyze it also the way you did it? Does the student internally say the same things to himself that you did?
I don't know what other people do. I don't know what other people do with that koan. The part. Thank you. Thank you very much.
The thought occurred to me right as you finished the story about the brown. What a delightful way to live your life. And I'm curious how that would relate to first part of the Eightfold Path, which is right perception.
Right perception?
Because it seems like to me you saw such vital aliveness because of the quality or the character of your perception, and that the koan would have to do with how we look at it.
I think it does. I mean, how you look at life would determine how you and a koan interact, that's for sure. Right perception has quite a bit to do with it, and the rest of the Eightfold Path as well. Someone said to me the other day, I wish it were a sevenfold path. I said, why? And he said, I don't know. Which one would you leave out? Which I,